surgical palliative care may seem counterintuitive, but surgeons have a rich history of palliating both their patients and their families. I am Red Hoffman, an acute care surgeon in Asheville, North Carolina, and one of 79 surgeons currently board certified in hospice and palliative medicine. Join me as I interview the founders and the leaders of the surgical palliative care movement, a diverse group of surgeons dedicated to providing high-quality palliative medicine to all surgical and trauma patients. Welcome to the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. We heal with more than steel. Hi, everybody. This is Red Hoffman. Thank you for joining me for another episode of the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. My co-host today is Dr. Pringle Miller. Pringle is an emergency general surgeon who also practices hospice and palliative medicine. Thanks so much for being here today, Pringle.
Thanks, Red. Looking forward to it.
Today, Pringle and I are so honored to be speaking with Dr. Jeff Dunn. Jeff is a general surgeon and the former medical director of the Palliative Care Consultation Service at UPMC Hammett Medical Center in Erie, Pennsylvania. He is the author of dozens of articles focused on surgical palliative care, as well as the editor of several books, including the recently released book entitled Surgical Palliative Care. Jeff, thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you. This is a great privilege for me.
So as we're getting started today, Jeff, can you share a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, where you trained, and why you decided to become a surgeon?
Well, there are many beginnings to that question. I grew up in Northwest Pennsylvania in the town of Erie, where my family's been settled since the 18th century. And that's relevant because I'm actually working on a memoirs of a fourth generation surgeon. We've all practiced in this area. We've all actually practiced in the same department of surgery in the same hospital. I didn't really seriously consider medicine as a career until I was almost finished with my undergraduate degree. And that was precipitated by a family emergency where it was almost like an inner voice. I think it was a gestational process. There had been hints along the way earlier in my life that maybe medicine would be the ultimate calling. But at that time, I was in art school, and I was beginning to have some doubts about whether that was really my future, just at the time where sort of the call to action seemed to come. And once I knew it was medicine, I knew automatically it would be surgery because that was a world I was pretty familiar with. And I always had reasonable manual dexterity and didn't have any reservations about that.
Well, I'm really looking forward to reading your memoir. I didn't know that was in the works. And also, it's nice to hear about your art background because I obviously know about your artistic talents, but didn't know that they dated back sort of before you took on surgery. So I think our listeners would like to hear a little bit more, Jeff, about your early surgical career, if you don't mind sharing.
Well, my index patient, and it's no HIPAA violation here, was my sister. She came dangerously close to a very mischievous horse named Mr. Chips, who took a grab at her right ear, nearly severing it. And I carried her home. And my father had a room that he referred to as the country office. In true surgical fashion, he said, put her down, hold on to her. And then to my sister, he told her, stop crying. And that was my first case. I was sort of acting as his assistant. I was impressed with myself because I noticed I didn't feel woozy at all. And he very deftly put in a few fine sutures. And I must say, had a result much better than many plastic surgeons I've seen since. Not long after that, I proceeded to open a booming practice operating on all my sister's dolls. We had plenty of surgical instruments in the house, lots of hemostats, and I remember planting a heart inside a Raggedy Ann's chest and just having dozens of hemostats all over this doll. I guess the origins go way, way back. During the pre-medical time in my life, I was very fortunate to have the opportunity to work in a pathology lab in our hospital. And at that time, autopsies were a daily occurrence in the hospital. They were doing about 600 or 700 autopsies a year. And this was, of course, before CT imaging or any other accurate way we could determine what a disease process was or a cause of death. And during that time, I was working as a prosector. I basically do all the removal of the organs and preparing everything for the pathologist to actually take sections. And during that time, surgeons were always coming down in those unfortunate situations where they were post-operative death. And it gave me a lot of insight into the surgical character and, of course, many of the dreaded complications of surgery, not to mention morbid anatomy. So that experience, even before I started medical school, really propelled me strongly towards surgery. I can still vividly remember the first time I saw liver metastases in a liver that had been completely replaced with a carcinoma of the colon. So by the time I got to medical school, I really felt very, very prepared in pathology or in anatomical pathology and actually had a pretty good start in anatomy. So fast forward, my training was at New England Deaconess. For me, overall, residency was a wonderful experience. It was really hard. This was in the days of 120 hours a week and often then some, frequent rotations where it really was every other night call. And it was during that time that some of the first, what became evident to me were some of the cracks in the wall of the enormous and powerful edifice of what we call our medical system, that I was in a place that had brilliant practitioners, a lot of accomplishment. It was considered a leading center in the world, very progressive in many ways. Yet I saw many situations that I thought were disturbing because of the blind spot to problems that were totally relevant to palliative care, a blind spot to the persona, to the psychological persona and issues, blind spot to the family, and basically a spiritual blind spot. And later, I found out that I wasn't the only one in Boston who was beginning to scratch their heads and saying, geez, maybe where there's greatness, error is also great. The shadows may be darkest where the lights are most brilliant. This is when Deepak Chopra, Dean Ornish, all those people were in Boston at the same time I was. And I think each of these individuals in their own way was beginning to question sort of medical orthodoxy, even in a place that was considered preeminent. And I observed that in my own experience as a resident. I remember we had a fellow we did a trisegmentectomy on. I had a real knocking of the heads with my chief, whose case it was, because he wanted to do it. And I really had doubts. I just didn't think this 70-plus-year-old guy had the reserve. I didn't think he would tolerate it. And it turned out I was right. And he postoperatively just gradually faded from hepatic insufficiency. During that time, I became very close to him and his wife and timed my rounds. I always come around 7 o'clock, which they referred to as cocktail hour. Don't worry, we didn't have cocktails. I think we had ginger ale. And we chat, and I felt became very close to them. And I remember thinking one night, I've done more good for this guy just by coming around every night than anything we did in the OR, and certainly any medical thing we did since. And fortunately, this is one of the few people who was firm enough, knew himself enough, and his family was supportive enough that he was able to negotiate a pretty peaceful demise in the hospital, which was quite an accomplishment in 1984, because at that point, hospice services were very, very in their kind of earliest days. The Medicare hospice benefit had only been around a year. There was nothing like palliative care. And the most rudimentary things that we take for granted for pain and symptom control, none of those things were researched or thought out or done well at all. I had other experiences, which included working overseas in India as a visiting professor. I'd been invited to inaugurate a critical care unit and start a burn unit in a very busy teaching hospital in Southwest India. And although it was very poor, there were numerous very capable practitioners. But the real problem dawning everybody were many of their material resources. Not long after the burn unit was started, we got the burn unit started. It was obvious to me it wasn't a burn unit. It was a burn hospice, because the overwhelming majority of the patients that had been brought there had 80% plus total body surface area burns. And even at MGH or any other noted center, trip any place, the salvage rate in 1988 was pretty slim with burns of that size. But in an environment like this, it was virtually unsalvageable. So I was stuck with the dilemma, what do you do if someone manages to survive, however briefly, from major burn, and you have absolutely no way of seeing a light at the end of the tunnel with respect to salvage and of survival? So that was the challenge. It was an intensely opiophobic environment, but I never forgot what did help in that environment, and that was engaging family, society, psychological, social, and spiritual support. That was the only counterstroke I could find to, you know, the devastating deficits that we had in terms of addressing their physical discomfort.
I'm curious, Jeff, so how did you end up turning these insights and experiences into a career in surgical palliative care?
It took a while. I think the experience made such a profound impact on me that I did what many people do. I kind of went into denial about it. And I noticed I was feeling restless, but I couldn't understand why. But having been in an environment like India, with all of its richness, but all the sort of vignettes of desperation I saw, it was really hard to feel settled when I came back for a few years. And then what really made it real was my mother was dying of breast cancer. And by that point, I'd had enough familiarity with local hospices here and actually been sort of available to them to help them out. And they needed a script or a physician to sign a form. At that time, the experience of my mother sort of gave me a chance to say, well, what would success look like if it was peaceful, if it was dignified, if there was good symptom control? And that's exactly what happened with her. And shortly after that, when I recognized I was really burned out from trauma call, from a number of other experiences, I decided to take a breather, and during that breather, I was approached by a new nursing agency for our hospital and said, geez, we need a medical director for our new hospice. Are you interested in it? Give you something to do while you're deciding how long leave you need. So I took it and right away went out on house calls and right away saw this was a whole world that in many ways, it's a blessing, but I thought in many ways was underserved. And the problems that were occurring, even under hospice care, there wasn't really good preparation or communication with the people who were referring. There were many people who were coming into hospice that still didn't really understand the implications of the services they were receiving, or they hadn't really achieved good symptom control. And then mid-90s, I began to be familiar with the writings of the first generation of hospice and palliative care in this country. I saw an article by Ira Byock about, gee, we need to get the medical specialties involved with this new field of palliative care. And he was the one who introduced me to Bob Milch. He told me about Bob Milch. he said, there's this great guy. He's a general surgeon. He lives near you. He was a hospice director already for a number of years. And you need to track him down, which I did, because Bob's only 100 miles from here. When we met each other, it was like long lost brothers. I mean, it was a wonderful meeting. We were both so excited. And right around that time, I'd been asked to speak to our local College of Surgeons chapter. That's when the light bulb really went off. And I thought, boy, it's really time to get back to the world of surgery with everything I've learned in this experience and get them on board with this. Shortly after that, those opportunities came.
It is amazing, Jeff, after having interviewed Bob, how similar your stories are and also how similar the language that you both use. And also when I interviewed Balmont, the language is all the same. It's quite fascinating to me. We're all kind of cut from the same cloth in some ways.
Yeah, I feel that way about you guys. When I was first getting introduced to each of you and talking on the phone, I said, Jesus, I almost feel like I'm in an echo chamber. She's saying exact things I was saying. You know, all the issues of how do you approach your colleagues and, you know, how do you deal with being dissed or, you know, all the nonsense about, you know, death squad and all that stuff. How do you deal with that? It says we all face the same thing, only different times.
I am curious, Jeff, can you define for the audience the term surgical palliative care?
It's the attention to suffering and all of its manifestations of the patient and the family under surgical care. It's not just surgical operations. That's a common confusion by some people, that palliative surgery. Palliative surgery is just a tool in the armamentarium of what we have at our disposal to address the needs of patients and their families seeking palliation from any form of symptom, whether it's physical, psychological, socioeconomic, or spiritual. And we have a role in that as surgeons. We have a very grave responsibility, because not only can we do more than anybody in many cases to address that kind of suffering, we can do more than anybody to create that suffering. So, like I said before, you know, where there is greatness, error is also great.
Yeah, you've been one of the persons that has really hit home for me just the surgical roots that we have and to reflect on those roots as palliators. And I think that as you've talked about, we sometimes deviate from all that we can do in palliation. But I love the imagery of how our specialty sort of was born through palliation. And we need to get back to that. You've touched on a bit of this question that I'm going to ask you already, but I'm wondering if you have any other thoughts or comments that you'd like to share with regard to your immersion in palliative care, how you feel that that's changed you as a person and as a surgeon.
Well, for me, it was more, in my case, unlike yours, which in many ways I sort of envy, for me, it was more of a tandem experience. The bulk of my career as a surgeon, where I was the operating surgeon, preceded my involvement with palliative care. Later in my palliative care career, I came back to the OR as an assistant, at least to be more currently informed of the problems and just the day-to-day of surgeons. And I was working in the surgical ICU. I didn't have the primary responsibility of operating when I was doing much of my work in palliative care. But I can kind of guess, if I'd had the framework of palliative care available for support and for my own reference, I think it might have made negotiating the problems early in my practice certainly easier to do, easier to understand. I think I would have been a better all-around doctor. I certainly would have been better at symptom control, which for me was kind of an annoying responsibility as a surgeon, rather than, you know, a moral calling that I'd be happy to address before anything else. I think that definitely changed in my experience. I think it does change your outlook. It certainly changed your outlook in terms of reframing any experience you have with a patient and their family, knowing that legacy, or what we sometimes refer to as the bereavement period, is a very important part of the story. And in some cases, it's the only part of the story.
I love that. Jeff, I've read that initially when the American College of Surgeons began talking about end-of-life care, it was really through the lens of the ethical debate regarding physician-assisted suicide. I know there was a symposium that was held on physician-assisted suicide back in 1997. Wondering, were you there? And like, what were the major takeaways of that day?
If I hadn't been there, I wouldn't be here.
Well, tell us about it.
It was probably the most pivotal moment of my life was that symposium. I had some help. It wasn't totally random. Bob and I had just written a piece discussing the surgeon and palliative care early in 1997. And because of that, I got asked to speak to a chapter of the College of Surgeons in Florida. And at that, another invited speaker was none other than Tom Krizek, who was a really heavy hitter in the college. He chaired the committee on ethics. He was known for his sophistication discourse on ethics. He was a tremendously courageous individual. He was a devout Catholic, brilliant plastic surgeon. He came to the talk that I gave, and I gave some fact about pain management and opioid tolerance. And he came up afterwards and he said, you know, that really got my attention. He said, I just never thought about these things. And he said, you know what, this fall, there's the Congress and there's a symposium on physician-assisted suicide and, you know, the agenda, everything is set. He said, but I want you to show up. He said, I might call on you because I'm moderating it. So I went to it with Bob, and this thing went on. It was all day, one of these all day deals. And they had about six people on the panel, pro and con physician assisted suicide. They had a oncologic surgeon from Yale who was all for it. They had Mark Ziegler, who was an ethicist who worked for years with the college against it. They had a burn surgeon, significantly, Dr. Freddie Ann, who was comparing the burn relationship with the burn patient, kind of a covenant. And he sort of liked to think that the burn unit atmosphere was not unlike a hospice. He was there. It was a very sophisticated panel. Tom moderated, and I thought I was safely off the hook. And then he said, well, we you know, ivory tower people, we've been batting this back and forth all day. He said, but today there's someone here who's in the trenches and is dealing with this stuff, a surgeon every day. And he said, Jeff Dunn. He looked, and at that point, I literally jumped on the floor. Bob started laughing, and then he kicked me. And so I walk up to this podium, all these people say, like, who's this clown? You know, and Krizek whispers to me, he said, okay, he said, you got 10 minutes to change surgery. Don't fuck it up.
Oh, that's amazing.
So I got up and I looked at this crowd, and what I remember was I had no sense of fear at all. It was more like, thank God I finally have a chance to put a shot across the bow. I said, well, we've been hearing all day about the pros and cons of physician-assisted suicide. I said, there's one thing that everybody agrees on and everybody actually said today, which is we've got to do better palliative care. I said, I'm going to make a promise to you, all of you right now. I will do everything I can to help you get there, but I'm going to need everybody's help. I can't do this alone. I'm from a community hospital. I'm not an academician. I'm not a researcher, but I am doing this every day. And I can tell you right now, these are the problems relevant to surgery. Problems related to overtreatment, problems to undertreatment, pain management. What is the proper place of artificial feeding and hydration? How do we talk to people about progressive disease? How do we comfort people once it's beginning to register? What do we do after someone dies? What do we do earlier in the course of illness when we see clouds on the horizon and symptom burden is beginning to derail the course of management? So I took about 10 or 15 minutes. There was dead silence. Then there was a lot of applause. And then I walked down, and immediately I got approached by about four or five people that I would consider sort of the most seasoned and senior people in the college at that time. They told me, you've got to keep after this. We will help you out. We'll get you on the program committee. Don't let this out of your hands. We'll help you out. But no one helped more than Olga Jonas. Not long after that, I met her, and I felt like, oh my God, I feel like I'm taking my oral boards all over again. Because she was not one to suffer fools gladly, I would put it that way. She said in her very discerning voice, well, I've read your article that you wrote with, who's this, Robert Milch, and it made a lot of sense. And he said, what do you think we should be doing about it in surgical education? And fortunately, I had a few answers. And she said, well, I'm going to make sure, you know, you're on the program committee. So our first presentation was at the college, and it was a very successful symposium. It was a good turnout. And it wasn't long after that that we got a grant, Robert Wood Johnson, and then that pulled the group together. And once that happened, we were in good shape, because virtually everything we had in our action item list from our very first meeting, every one of those things has come to fruition, especially with you folks doing a real fellowship, taking real boards and doing this. That was our end point. That was our end goal. All the other things, you know, research agenda, getting out more literature, putting on educational program, all that stuff has happened in the meantime. And that's why I'm so glad you're interested in this, because I can back away easily knowing that the situation's in excellent hands.
Well, can you then connect the dots between what you just told us about the symposium and the task force, the American College of Surgeons Surgical Palliative Care Task Force?
Well, after that symposium, there was kind of a little quiet period. And during that, that was an important period for me, because then it was 1998 that I approached Bal Mount. I remember screwing up my courage one wintry day in my farmhouse. I thought, all right, I'm going to call him. Maybe he'll be ticked off, or maybe I won't even be able to reach him. And he answered the phone right away. It was very, as you have seen for yourselves, extremely congenial. I said, I'm a surgeon interested in palliative care. I'd like to get some traction with this idea among surgeons in this country. Do you know of any surgeons who you feel are knowledgeable in this area or could take this on with my assistance? And there was this long pause on. And then he said, well, that would be you. And not long after that, I had the good fortune meeting Dame Cecily Saunders. And the reason that happened was my father was a surgeon, founded a hospice here in Erie in 1980. In sort of recognition of his services, when she came to Erie for a big hospice associated meeting, they arranged a visit for her out at his house out in the country. So I was there to meet her, and I felt the same way I did when I met Olga. I thought, God, I feel like I'm taking my boards again, and I can't screw this up. Here's the founder of the modern hospice movement in my living room with my father looking on. You know, and she had a number of questions, but she was very encouraging.
Looking back, Jeff, what do you think were the most significant accomplishments of that task force?
I think it was outlining a clear set of priorities, identifying the minimum deliverables for the practicing surgeon. We made it pretty simple. We didn't expect them to be each member of the interdisciplinary team, but we would hope that any surgeon would know when to call the interdisciplinary team. We would expect any surgeon to know the basics of communication of difficult news. We would expect any surgeon to be proficient in the management of uncomplicated pain problems and other salient non-pain symptoms. We would expect any surgeon to be familiar, recognize signs of impending demise. So I think that was important. I think it was important just to plant the flag for the idea in this series of articles and JACs and getting chapters on palliative care in the some of the well-known surgical textbooks. I'm very proud of that happening. And we were lucky because the the people wrote for them, Dan Hinshaw, others did such a good job doing that. But I think the biggest success was getting your generation on board and becoming part of the group that was certified, you know, through the ABS. And you can thank Olga Jonasson for that. She said, you know, there's this group of boards, primary boards, that want to create a new board exam in hospice and palliative medicine, and surgery may or may not sign on. She said, but I need something to go to the other. I need something to go to ABS so we can sign on. And you are going to write it. Yes, sir. You never said no to Olga. If you want your intellectual self-respect, you know, to remain intact.
I'm curious, what have you found to be the best approaches to engaging other surgeons and finding the value of palliative care for surgical patients?
Well, boy, never preach. Do not be an evangelist. Hear them out. Sooner or later, they'll notice, gee whiz, this person's always listening to me. She's hanging around and, you know, gets mad at the same things I get mad at, hates EMR, you know, hates administration. You know, this guy's a regular fellow. I kind of crept up on my, I said, you know, I can tell you really feel you know, we're really cornered to this malignant bowel obstruction. The last case I was involved with as a chief resident was a woman with a advanced ovarian cancer and malignant bowel obstruction. And I'll never forget the surgeon were at the scrub thing saying, well, this is an exercise in futility. And I'm thinking, well, why the hell are we doing this? This is ridiculous. And of course, the operative findings proved he was right. And the best we could do for that person was a G2. And then terrible post-op, you know, pain management with, you know, a whopping 50 of Demerol, IM, PRN, and that was it. And no preparation of family. But I remember thinking, if I get one specific thing off the table in my lifetime as a surgeon, is going to be operating on people with malignant bowel obstruction with extremely limited life expectancy. I said, that has got to go. And if you ask me, what am I personally proud of? It's anything that I might have done to make it easier for people to do that. And now it is a lot easier because we not only can put a peg in people, but we've gotten much better at doing the symptom control and much, much better at having the conversation that allows people to opt out of surgery. Mm-hmm. That is a big change from 1984. I can promise you, anyone with malignant obstruction then was going to get an operation unless they were absolutely agonal.
And Jeff, kind of in follow-up to that question, why do you think that surgeons are so well-suited to practice palliative care?
Because I think they really do care about suffering. It's just the way they choose to deal with it. It's almost like you're fighting fire with fire. You're inflicting a little discomfort and some discomfort and pain in order to prevent and to treat a much greater discomfort.
So, Jeff, I know you've been very prolific in your writings about surgical palliative care. One of the most memorable things that I've read from you is your approach to a family meeting and how you compare it to a surgical procedure. In fact, I based my whole family conference chapter in the surgical palliative care book on that principle, and I appreciate you letting me run with it. But I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that.
Metaphor is probably one of the most civilizing influences that I can think of, because it allows someone to go from one experience to another and stay in the same boat. But I thought, gosh, what language could I use that would make sense to surgeons? And then I realized, well, you know, it's very obvious to anyone who's been on either end of it that a disclosure of a really bad news, it is an invasive procedure. Invasive in the sense that once it's been delivered, the person's life will change forever, no matter how, how it's perceived or what happens. They will never be the same person. So number one, it's an invasive procedure. Okay, check. That makes sense to surgeons. Number two, you have to have courage. You know, you've got to be organized, just the way you do for a dawning operation. You got to have some spine, but you need to be organized. You can't just shoot from the hip or be unprepared. Number two, I think at your peril, you have some of these discussions all by yourself because of the dangers of misperception on either side. So always have somebody with you, a support figure, whether it's for the family or for yourself. You know, you have an OR assistant. Number three, you know, setting is obviously important. You don't have the conversation in the hall. You don't do your operation in the lobby. You know, and the more I thought about it, I said, gosh, this is a perfect fit. So basically, the way you make the discussion of bad news relevant to surgeons is you impress upon them, this is like doing an operation, and it's just as important to do it well. And the consequences, believe it or not, can actually be more grave than if you botched up or screwed up a real operation.
Those are just so powerful, those words. And I just really admire the direction that you've taken surgery and surgical palliative care.
You know, as a lover of history, I had a few people in mind when I started getting more and more into this. I kept thinking and reading about them more. And people are always shocked. And I tell them, well, who had a big influence on you? And I think, well, there were two figures in history. One's fairly predictable, was Semmelweis, someone who did the right thing, saved countless lives, but, you know, paid the ultimate price of his sanity for doing that. The other, which really shocked people, was Ulysses Grant, U.S. Grant. This was someone who really had a hard time getting his oar in the water. It really took a big problem for him to show what he could do. But the reason he was able to do it was he had singleness of purpose. He was successful because he never got off task about what is the nature of the enemy, what is the nature of his task.
Well, thank you for that. I think we're wrapping up. We would like to sort of end on the note of the future. What do you think some of the important goals for surgical palliative care, for sort of this emerging, developing surgical palliative care community are moving forward?
Well, I think the key thing is stick together, not only with each other, those of you who've, you know, I always saw us as a fellowship within the fellowship, the people that were specifically interested in surgical palliative care within the fellowship of the college, within the general fellowship of all surgeons and doctors. So stick together and stick with the other surgeons. Don't let the surgical palliative care community drift away from the concerns and the pursuits and the problems of all the different surgical subspecialties. I think the danger of that is getting greater all the time as they become more specific and refined. I think AI, electronic, all these things, social media, these are all things that, thank God, we have you folks, your generation, to bridge that, because I wouldn't know what to do with it. But I'd be stupid if I didn't recognize its importance in things. So to stay on top of that. Palliation has been the oldest call in surgery, and it will be the last call of surgery.
Oh, that's perfect. Jeff, as we're finishing up, is there anything you'd like to add?
No, except that I can't tell you how delightful it's been to have a chance to talk with you and reflect on this. I feel very grateful because I'm writing my own memoirs now. Someone once wrote that, although surgery is the treatment of suffering and disease with mechanical means, it is primarily a moral education. And I think that's not only true for surgical education, I think that's true for the practice of surgery. And it's not only a moral education for surgeons, it's a moral education for society. I think what we've accomplished in the field of surgery since the mid-19th century has been a tremendous achievement of civilization. And because of that, the impact on morality and the future morality in all human endeavors is important, and we should stick with it.
Thank you so much, Jeff. I just have to say, you know, when I first Googled surgical palliative care, the first thing that came up was your name and the resident's guide to surgical palliative care. And so from the very beginning, you have been such inspiration to me and such a force. In fact, when I did my grand rounds as a chief resident, I had a big picture of you and Ann Mosenthal up there. Fast forwarding all these years, I feel so much gratitude to you. I feel like, one, you've been such a recorder of our history, and it's been so great to hear you articulate all of that today. And then I just feel, on a very personal level, I really have appreciated how generous you've been with me in introducing me to so many people, in supporting my idea of doing this podcast, and of just being such a mentor to me. So I really thank you from the very bottom of my heart. This has been amazing for me as like a surgeon and as a person. So thank you.
Yeah. Well said, Red.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, you think of all of the folks out there that you've inspired. It's wonderful.
No, thank you. Boy, it doesn't get any better than that.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for your time, both of you.
Thank you.
Everybody stay in touch.
That sounds lovely. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on the latest episodes. To learn more about the surgical palliative care community, follow us on Twitter at SurgePalCare. If you'd like to get more involved with the Surgical Palliative Care social media team, please reach out on Twitter or via email at surgicalpalliativecare@gmail.com. Lastly, take good care of yourselves and take good care of each other.